So I just want to say that this talk is really not for experts. So I really ask for patience from experts. But I think I try to include some interesting tidbits that the experts may not be aware of. And my goal is really to convey a feel for the subject and what the issues are and what the general state of the art is. And I'm really trying to address myself to the people in the black hole workshop, the astrophysics workshop, condensed matter physicists, etc. in the audience. And the choice of topics I chose, I mean, I had to make a selection, and the choice was dictated, or influenced at least, by this other program on black holes and astrophysics. So I want to just divide this talk in four parts. First, I'll tell you about the necessity of quantum gravity. Why should we have a quantum gravitation field? Then I'll sort of tell you a few hints and challenges. Then I'll tell you some examples of recent results. And then I'll end with some checks on what one might have on various, on the existing as well as future results on quantum gravity from theoretical consistency and from experiments. The first really reason that why we should really have, why we need a quantum gravitational field is, so to say, to cure schizophrenia. And this is something that we have, we all of us have. When you look at the macro world, when you look at astrophysics cosmology, we just use general relativity. And, you know, we worry about space-time curvature, geometry. We worry about propagation equations, nonlinear equations, hyperbolic systems, etc., etc. And then when we talk about quantum mechanics, we completely change our hat. And then we talk about Hilbert spaces, operators. One description, the first one, is sort of geometric and deterministic. The second one is sort of probabilistic. And one sort of feels that if there is, there should be unity in a description of nature at a fundamental level. And somehow these two pieces should come out as special cases. And so it's really for sort of overall consistency that we look for this. And this necessity of a quantum gravitational field was actually recognized quite early on. And for a long time, I was aware of the papers that were written in the 30s on necessity of, you know, debating the necessity of quantum gravitational field. But recently, Lee Smolin pointed out to us that, in fact, there is a very early reference, and probably the earliest reference, on need of quantum gravity, because this came in 1916, and this is by Einstein. And it's also very surprising that it's actually by Einstein. And I think this is a paper in which Einstein is discussing the weak field limit. I think the title is something like the approximate integration of the field equations of new theory of gravity, and it's in the proceedings of the Prussian Academy. And he is sort of talking about these weak fields, and then he says, nevertheless, due to the inner atomic movement of electrons, atoms would have to radiate not only electromagnetic, but also gravitational energy, if only in tiny amounts. As this is hardly true in nature, it appears that quantum theory would have to modify not only Maxwellian electrodynamics, but also the new theory of gravitation. And this came just 1 year after the discovery of general relativity.
He says it's hardly true in nature, but if you compute the rate of decay of an atom to gravitational radiation, it would be extremely slow.
It would be very, very slow, right, exactly.
You
so
probably wouldn't have noticed.
We probably wouldn't have noticed, that's correct. Right. But I'm just trying to tell you that there's an early history to the subject matter. But then in the 30s, there was a discussion, I think, primarily due to Rosenfeld, in which the idea was proposed that perhaps we should really, why do we need to quantize gravity? Perhaps we should really consider a classical gravitational field and a quantum matter field, and perhaps as in a fundamental theory, we should have Einstein tensor, which is really the curvature tensor, should be related to the expectation value of stress energy tensor. So that matter, which is all quantum, this is all classical, and we got this as a basic equation. And then there was some discussion. Unfortunately, in the meanwhile, I've forgotten all the details of what happened. But in the 70s, several people took this idea seriously and tried to sort of see if, in fact, it is viable. and came up with the following argument, which says that we really cannot have this as our fundamental theory. And the reason is because if you choose textbook quantum mechanics, standard textbook quantum mechanics, then, and if in fact this equation holds as a fundamental equation, then there would be really a possibility to see instantaneous, to send instantaneous signals, if that holds. So what is the idea? The idea is really very simple. I mean, so supposing there are two stations. I think in those days people were still worried about the Cold War. So they said, well, there are two stations, one and two, and one wants to send a signal to two saying that the Russians are coming. I think this was the thing that it was, the way it was said. And we want to do it instantaneously. And so the idea is the following, that you take this a photon, which is figuratively called a 14-pound photon. This is all slightly tongue-in-cheek, right? So you take some object, like, you know, so something whose gravitational field is measurable. So we take this photon, and we just beam split it in the usual way. And so we've got two stations, one and two. And the idea is that if, in fact, at a fundamental level, the gravitational field is classical, then we should be able to continuously measure the gravitational field at both these stations without disturbing the system, without causing any wave function collapse or anything like that. And so that's what we do. And now what we will find is, roughly, what we will find is that at each station there will be a gravitational field of a 7-pound photon, because the probability is half that the photon is here and half that the photon is there. This was done much more carefully than I'm saying right now, but... Now, supposing one wants to send an instantaneous signal to the station 2, then the observer here, so the idea is that both of them, actually, we don't really need to have one measuring the gravitational field, but we need to have two measuring the gravitational field continuously. And now the idea is that to send the signal, this observer, she makes a measurement of the photon, tries to find if the photon is there or not. Photon is quantum mechanical. This was this operator up here, if you like. So it's quantum mechanical, therefore the wave function collapses, and then either she finds that the photon is here, or she doesn't find that the photon is here. But if she finds the photon is here, then in this particular rest frame of the apparatus, the wave function would collapse instantaneously, and one would find that the gravitational field at the station 2 would drop to zero instantaneously, because the photon is really here. On the other hand, if she finds that the photon is not here, then the gravitational field at station 2 would double instantaneously. In either case, there would be an instantaneous signal. 2 would immediately know that something has happened. And it doesn't matter really which of the possibilities occurs. And this really is possible because one is trying to continuously monitor the gravitational field. In other words, one field is classical, and one can continuously monitor it without causing the wave function to collapse. Now, there are more serious and important reasons for why we really do need a quantum theory of gravity, and they go, for example, they arise, for example, from the fact that both general relativity and quantum field theory have built into them, so to say, really intrinsic limitations. General relativity predicts infinities, singularities. Quantum field theories predict infinities, and the belief from early days was that this is what is happening because we're assuming that space-time is continuum at all scales, and perhaps quantum gravity would give you a cutoff. It would modify both quantum field theory by giving you a cutoff, and it would modify general relativity and then thus make singularity, so to say, go away. Okay. So now this was just sort of just general introduction, general motivation. And now let me tell you a little bit about hints and challenges. The first thing that I want to use as a hint comes from black holes, and primarily I guess I chose this because it's a bridge between the two programs up here. And this comes from black hole thermodynamics. I think everybody here is probably familiar with the general ideas, but I just want to pinpoint a couple of things which are perhaps not often emphasized as much as they should be. Because everybody assumes that it's obvious, but in a general talk, I think I should emphasize them. Namely, let's consider, first of all, classical general relativity. Then in the 70s, Jim Bardeen, Brandon Carter, and Stephen Hawking showed that entirely within classical general relativity, so h bar is really equal to zero, one can show that black holes have certain properties. The first property is that there is a quantity called the surface gravity associated with the black holes, and that this quantity is constant for stationary black holes. So the black holes may be rotating, they may not be spherical, yet this quantity is constant on the horizon, on the surface of the black hole. Then you have got the first law of black hole mechanics, which says that, well, if you have a black hole and you go from one black hole stationary configuration to another black hole stationary configuration, then in fact there's going to be, it doesn't have to be necessarily stationary, to a nearby configuration, then the change in the mass of the black hole is given by the is related to the change in the area of the horizon of the black hole and the surface gravity by this formula. These work terms have to do with adding rotation or adding charge to the black hole. And the last equation was, the last equation is that the area of the event horizon of the black hole never decreases if you assume that the matter satisfies the usual energy conditions of general relativity, that one assumes in general relativity, so this is always non-negative. Now, as one can see, there is a remarkable similarity between these laws and the basic laws of thermodynamics. If you say that kappa is like the temperature, and if you say that area is analogous to entropy. However, we can't really make kappa equal to temperature and area equal to entropy, because, for example, area has dimensions of length square, and entropy is dimensionless, and in classical general relativity, we don't have G and C, don't give us enough tools to construct a fundamental length. So there is no really way of relating these two quantities exactly within classical general relativity. But then, just a year later, there was a discovery due to Stephen Hawking of the Hawking effect. Now, what happened in Hawking effect is that one used quantum field theory in curved space-time. So one left gravity classical, but one quantized various matter fields on this black hole background geometry. And then Stephen found that when you do the calculation in detail, that black holes actually, due to quantum mechanical tunneling, radiate as if they are black bodies, and there is a temperature associated with the radiation, and that temperature is indeed given by h bar times surface gravity upon 2 pi. But then, if this was the case, it was natural to take sort of the next step and say that, well, so black holes themselves should be assigned a temperature, namely this temperature of radiation should be the same as the temperature of the black hole itself. And if you say that the temperature of the black hole is equal to h bar k upon 2 pi, now we can go up here, and in order to have the complete correspondence with the first law of thermodynamics, which says that the change in energy is equal to T temperature times change in the entropy, you find that you should assign an entropy to the black hole, which is given by area upon 4 times the Planck length squared. Now, these arguments are sort of very nice, and because they bring together, you know, the three fundamental theories, general relativity, quantum field theory, and statistical mechanics, they're very compelling. But on the other hand, they really are ad hoc in the same sense as, for example, Bohr's model of atoms was ad hoc. There is something clearly right about it, but it involved a sort of hodgepodge mixture of ideas from classical physics and semi-classical physics, and a similar thing is happening up here. And therefore, the question arises, can we understand all this from first principle, and is there, in fact, a statistical mechanical derivation of the temperature of the black hole? Can we, for example, construct a microcanonical ensemble of some things which will really describe the black hole, a large black hole, and then define the temperature by really systematically taking the derivative of the number of states with respect to the energy, and that will give us beta, 1 upon temperature. And so can we do that? And similarly, can we count the number of states, and we'll find that, in fact, the entropy is given by this particular formula. And so this is a concrete challenge that is that was posed for all potential quantum theories of gravity. So now, let's see what we do normally. If we have some simple systems, like the familiar ones in statistical mechanics, when we want to do things like compute the microcanonical ensemble and compute the thermodynamical properties, we usually have to identify the microscopic degrees of freedom, and then we construct the ensemble, and then we sort of turn on the standard methods of statistical physics, and we get our usual answers. So, for example, if a system is a gas in a box, right, then the microscopic degrees of freedom that we are looking at are given by molecules. If it's a radiation field in a black body cavity, then the microscopic degrees of freedom are given by photons. If it is really a magnet, for example, then the microscopic degrees of freedom are given by spins. So now we want to ask, supposing we take a large black hole, what are the corresponding microscopic degrees of freedom? So already there is a hint that these microscopic degrees of freedom should come from quantum gravity, because what else is there? But on the other hand, they cannot be gravitons, because the fields in question are all stationary, that time independent. They're not radiative at all. So this already suggests that whatever these constituents there are have to be essentially non-perturbative in nature. And this is the reason, I think, why the task of actually finding these constituents and trying to doing the statistical mechanics for a black hole has been very difficult, and there has been progress only relatively recently. The basic ideas have been around from black hole thermodynamics have been around since mid-70s, and so it took almost 20 years to make this to make progress in this particular topic. Okay. The second sort of hint and challenge that we get comes from quantum nature of geometry. We already saw that we should not really consider this equation as an expectation value equation. So therefore, if in fact this object, matter, is going to be quantum mechanical, then so should the left-hand side. The left-hand side is a geometry, is a curvature, and therefore it says that if matter is quantum mechanical, so must geometry be. On the one hand, it sort of seems like almost elementary, it's not obviously. But then when you stop and think, what does it mean? It does sound very striking. Because what we are saying is that all the continuum picture that we have of the geometry around us has to change, has to be replaced by something else at the fundamental level, and has to be replaced. In other words, the classical differential geometry that we use is a very beautiful, nice tool, but it is only of limited application and has to be replaced by some other tool, by some other branch of mathematics, if you like, which will tell us about quantum geometry. The physical questions are then, well, matter, we know, has constituents. There are atoms, and atoms in the Greek sense of the word. There are constituents, elementary building blocks. And so now we want to ask, well, is the same thing true about geometry? Geometry is a physical quantity, so does it have also atoms? I mean, look at the surface of the table. It looks nice and smooth. But look at it more and more closely, and you will see the atomic structure up here. I look around me. Space looks smooth and continuum. I wave my hands smoothly through the space. But on the other hand, if I really looked at it very, very closely, would it also have some microscopic structure, some fundamental building blocks? If, in fact, geometry is to be treated as a physical entity, as we do in classical general relativity, so if you have to take this idea seriously in quantum gravity, then are there physical processes in which quanta of geometry can be converted into quanta of matter, and quanta of matter can be converted into quanta of geometry? New kinds of physical processes. Just as we learned that we have got these processes in which, you know, matter can be converted into energy, and vice versa, do we have similar processes here? In a very rough sense, it is true that you can think of black hole formation as a process in which you can have some quanta of matter, they all collapse, they form a black hole geometry, so there's a conversion in this direction. And you can think of black hole evaporation, because black hole has some horizon, has some areas, has some geometry, and as it evaporates, it shrinks, and so you can think of that as being a conversion of geometry into matter. And then finally, our singularities of general relativity and divergences of quantum field theory, artifacts of our pushing the continuum picture too far. This was suggested in the early days by various people, starting with Heisenberg and so on. And the question is that something that is indeed happening? And now, over the past decade, concrete proposals have emerged to address such issues, and there has been significant progress, and there has been significant enthusiasm. However, before I go that, I just want to make a general remarks about the nature of the subject as such. And I want to say that there really is a key difficulty in this field, as we all know. And the key difficulty is that we really do not have direct experimental checks. I mean, the situation is very different from discovery of quantum mechanics. When people were discovering quantum mechanics, one was loaded with experimental facts. And the problem was really, how do you explain these experimental facts? So there are too many of them in some sense. Here, we have almost the opposite problem. There are too few of them. There's hardly any experimental fact that needs really quantum gravity. And therefore, I think by necessity, the approaches are driven by intellectual prejudices. It has to do with what one thinks are the core issues. I mean, here is a problem which has many, many, many dimensions. So some people, for example, starting with one extreme, think that the fact that we have this discomfort about measurement theory of quantum mechanics is really something that is telling us something about quantum gravity, which should really come from this end. Some other people would feel that, well, the fact that the quantum field theories have been so successful and we have unified picture of basic interactions, you know. Therefore, the fundamental issue is really not just to look at gravity, but to look at the whole picture and construct a unified theory of nature, of which gravity would just be one part. Some other people feel that, well, a central lesson of general relativity was that geometry is dynamical. And if we understand the quantum nature of geometry, and perhaps the picture would change so significantly that one could then add other matter fields and face the problem of unification in the second step. So everybody believes what one wants to get. The question is, how are you going to approach it? And there's a lot of approaches, and here is just a partial list. String theory, the most well-known, and I guess we already had a couple of pedagogical talks on this, and we're going to continue to have them in this program. Then there is this quantum geometry or loop quantum gravity. We'll have a few pedagogical talks on that starting in March sometime. Then there is the Euclidean path integrals. This method has been particularly successful in trying to understand the black hole thermodynamics picture, for example, as Stephen explained in his lecture just last Friday, than the Friday before that. And also, I think this was used in Rob Mann's talk, this idea of Euclidean path integrals. It is also sort of the underlying framework for many results in quantum cosmology. So it's a active area. Then there is Regge calculus. This is an area in which what one does is one takes the continuum space-time, and one, so it's a space-time geometry, and one approximates it by elementary cells. It is very much like you take a surface of a ball and you triangulate it. You approximate it by a bunch of triangles which are all flat. Each surface is flat, but the curvature is then all concentrated at vertices. So we try to do similar things in higher dimensions and then try to write down Einstein action and try to, for example, do the functional integrals. Then there are some approaches which are iconoclastic in the sense that they reject the standard starting points. In these approaches, some of the standard starting points have been kept, whereas there are some approaches in which they reject them. One idea is so-called poset. So the idea is that we sort of say start from scratch completely. At a fundamental level, one posits, one makes an assumption that all we have is points with causal relations among them. And then one also write down an action and so on using this very, very elementary structure. And the hope is that somehow when one has done it right, one would actually see that the classical limit is general relativity, and then there is, in suitable sense, you get quantum field theory, etc., etc. There is twister theory, in which the idea is to say that the fundamental space-time is a really derived concept. The fundamental object is a certain four-dimensional complex manifold, complex space, called twister space. The laws of physics would be simpler if one is they are formulated in this mass, the twister space, and then we just do translation to space-time. Related to twister space is an approach which has been called NSF, and that is just called null surface formulation, where the idea is that the fundamental object should not be either the metric tensor or or strings or anything like that, but should really be surfaces which happen to be null in space-time. And somehow we should write down equations on when these surfaces are when a surface can be null in a given space, in some asymptotically flat space-time. And then, in other words, when does there exist a metric such that a given surface constructed by some universal construction is null? And then write down equations which say when this metric is satisfies, say, Einstein's equation. The related approach is asymptotic quantization. It's actually related to Euclidean path integrals in some certain way, in which one looks only at null infinity and tries to look at it. It's a very asymmetric theory kind of approach. And however, one allows paths which can have arbitrary topology, which can intervene between null infinity to null infinities. There are, of course, matrix models. I think there's a talk just immediately after this one on matrix models. And, of course, in early days, there were things like membranes. Now, of course, some of these membranes, at least, have been already observed in string theory. And so there is a variety of approaches, I want to say. And I personally feel that this variety is very healthy and is very good for the field, in part because of the history of the subject. I mean, general relativity was discovered in 1915, quantum mechanics around 1925. So this problem has been with us for a very long time. There have been sort of phases, periods, in which one thought that the problem was close to being solved. And for example, let me share one personal incident with you. This is when I was a graduate student and I had, I think, my first committee meeting with my PhD committee, right? And then I was asked, well, what are your interests? So I told them a few things in general relativity, and I said, well, I'm also interested in quantum gravity. And so one of the distinguished members of the committee, sort of a high-end theorist, said, oh, but you know the problem has been solved. And this was in the early mid-70s. And I think what was being referred to was that just a few months ago, a few months before that, I think Fadiyar and Papa, or maybe a year before that, Fadiyar and Papa had come up with a paper of really Fadiyar-Papa determinants and how to do systematically perturbation theory. And so I guess some people felt enthusiastic that that was, in other words, Feynman had started perturbation theory, and then this was going to solve this perturbation theory. Most of us know, for example, that n equal to 8 supergravity seemed like a natural candidate for the, for the theory of gravity. From the point of view of field theory perspective, this has many, many natural ingredients, and it was really called the final theory. And in fact, we know that Stephen Hawking actually gave his Lucasian lecture, right, whose title was "Is End of Physics in Sight?" And the end of physics in sight was, the final theory was n equal to 8 supergravity. And there's very good reason for such optimism. I'm not trying to sort of downplay it. But what I'm trying to say is the problem has been around for a long time. And every now and then good ideas come. There is a lot of optimism. But on the other hand, these ideas have not yet borne out. And therefore, the variety in the whole approach is really something that is very good, very healthy. And in this program in particular, we certainly have string theory and quantum geometry represented. We already had Euclidean path integrals represented. Some of the twisted people would be here, and we hope that there will be a lot of interaction between various ideas up here. In particular, the whole point of this pedagogical lecture series was to set up such interaction between various approaches. Sort of the second thing, I think, second pitch I can make in favor of this variety is essential is his advice that Richard Feynman gave. Richard Feynman came back from his Nobel Prize in Stockholm, and on his way stopped in CERN, and he had this thing to say at the end of his talk. He said, he was addressing younger people in CERN. He said, it is very important that we do not all follow the same fashion. It is necessary to increase the amount of variety. And the only way to do it is to implore you few guys to take a risk with your lives that you will never be heard of again, and go off in the wild blue yonder and see if you can figure it all out. And I think in some sense that is what is happening. I mean, to many people, many of these approaches look crazy, but that's what people are doing. They're going out in the wild blue yonder and trying to see if they can figure it out. Okay. But this general philosophical or whatever it is, a general musing that I just had, may give the wrong impression, may give the impression that, oh, there are many approaches, many directions, and we don't know where the field is moving. I think that's not right. I think especially over the last 10 years, the field has a sense of direction, and that is why there is so much enthusiasm and so much energy in the field. I think Steve and Gary already told you about developments in string theory, this black hole conference, and therefore I'm going to sort of focus on a few other developments just to tell you that there are concrete results which make people very enthusiastic and optimistic. So let me just give you a few examples here. So these are not meant to be the most important examples or anything, they're just illustrative things to convey the kinds of issues one works with, to give you the level of mathematical sophistication, the physical ideas, how far one is from achieving what one wants to achieve, or how close one is. So that is what, these are just illustrations. So one of the things that we saw early on was that you believe that just because of Einstein's equation, the geometry should be quantum mechanical. Well, that's easily said, but now we want to ask the question, is geometry quantized then? Well, what do you mean by that question? So let us take a familiar example. Let us take a harmonic oscillator where the equation of motion, we can go to the phase space for the harmonic oscillator, and on that we can write down an observable, the Hamiltonian. And we find that this observable takes on continuous values, right, on the phase space. It can change continuously. But when you come to quantum mechanics, the states are not represented by points in the phase space. They are represented by elements of Hilbert space. The Hamiltonian is now an operator, and what we are supposed to do is to look for its spectrum. We are supposed to look for its eigenvalues. And in this case, the eigenvalues are discrete, and we say, so energy is quantized. So the question is, does the similar thing happen to geometry? There are geometry quantities. I can take a curve, you can compute its length, right? Or I can take a surface, you can compute its area, or I can take this region, compute its volume. All these quantities are functions on the phase space of gravity. Say, phase space of general relativity, for example. Because a gravity theory provides us a metric, and given that metric, I can compute all these quantities. And you go and look at another point in the phase space, another metric, I can again compute these quantities. So these are functions on the gravitational phase space. And the statement is that classically, all these quantities, of course, take on continuous values. So our task then is to answer the question, is geometry quantized, is the following. We should construct a Hilbert space for gravity. We should introduce on it these operators corresponding to the length, area, volume, etc., and compute their eigenvalues. And then we want to ask, are these eigenvalues discrete? If they are discrete, we would say the geometry is quantized. If the spectrum is continuous, then we would not have this particular result. So it's very easy to state all these results, these ideas. So why is it that it has taken so long, right? I mean, these could have been stated just after the hydrogen atoms. Well, the problem is that the standard field theoretical methods that have been available are perturbative. By that I mean, they assume that you are given a background space-time. And if you assume that you have a continuum picture in the background and then want to do perturbation theory order by order and see if a discreteness emerges, that certainly is possible in principle, but it's very, very hard in practice. For example, take the harmonic oscillator that we had up here. Right? And if I said that, well, one should really do perturbation theory of harmonic oscillator of a free particle. So here the spectrum of the energy is completely continuous, and I'll treat this as a perturbation. Well, I mean, if you did it right, and if you summed everything, and if you are very careful, you would see the right result. But as it's obvious that it's going to be difficult to see the discreteness until one has summed up the perturbation series or one has done it all completely right. So the problem was that the required background independent methods were not available, and that they were only systematically introduced in the 90s. And what this needed was really a new functional calculus, which does not refer to background space-time metric, if you like. And using that then, using the integral calculus, you can talk about square integral functions and so on, and construct the Hilbert space of states for gravity. And one can use differential calculus, you know, which lets us introduce things like vector fields and Laplacians and so on this on a suitable infinite dimensional space. One can construct geometric operators. And then one can ask the question, do they have discrete spectrum? And these results are mathematically rigorous. They are not approximations, so they are not something, there is nothing slid by hand, so to say there. And the statement is that all these operators indeed have discrete eigenvalues. So in this sense then, geometry, in this particular way of approach, geometry is indeed quantized. So how does this work? Just to give a general feeling for how this works. Well, the starting point is the following. Normally, we think of general relativity or supergravity as theories in which gravity is represented by a metric. The idea is to change the focus a little bit, and we're not changing the theories, they're the same series. But we're just writing it in terms of mathematical quantities, which make them look closer to the theories of electroweak and strong interactions. And so to say, these mathematical quantities are connections or vector potentials. So these are to be used as the basic gravitational variables. And then one borrows some of the techniques that have been very successful, especially in the theory of strong interactions. And the states then of the quantum gravity, in this particular way of looking at it, are built from gravitational analogs of Wilson loops. Of the circuit integrals of potentials that we normally consider. So as a result, the fundamental excitations of geometry are one-dimensional. So there are these flux lines, you know, it's like in space, like in kinematic physics, if you like, and what are these fluxes of? Well, they're flux lines of area. So the statement is basically that, in a very elementary sense, if I have a flux line which threads some surface, then it gives this surface a quantum of area. If I have two flux lines, it gives you two quantums of area. I'm simplifying slightly because these flux lines themselves carry a quantum number, so it's not that they give it one quantum of area, but they give it as much area as many quantum of area as this quantum number that they carry has. Okay. So for example, this will have a quantum number j, and so I'll get j times Planck length squared as an area here, very roughly speaking. Okay, so because the fundamental excitations are one-dimensional, therefore the idea is that the geometry is really like a polymer. I want to sort of put this in inverted commas. I'm not saying that there is a one-to-one mathematical correspondence between theory of polymers and this theory of geometry. It is only polymer in this sense. There are some similarities, but... And then these are really these flux lines of area that we have here. And the idea is that the continuum picture arises as a coarse-grained approximation. So it's very similar to what happens to, you know, the fabric, right? The fabric is really woven by threads that are one-dimensional, but for all practical purposes, you see it as being a two-dimensional continuum up here. So the idea is that the space around us is very similar. It is woven by these threads, by these flux lines, and if they are suitably dense and suitably compact, then if you coarse-grain, then you can approximate what is going on with a smooth geometry. So smooth geometry is an approximation that arises in this particular way. A continuum geometry is an approximation. Just to give you a sort of feel for this kind of, you know, what is the level of results that one has. First of all, the most elementary operator, the simplest operators to deal with are the area operators, because these flux lines have, in other words, the fundamental states have a very simple interpretation in terms of area. Therefore, one can do more here. So first of all, in this case, there's an analytical formula for all eigenvalues. So we know all the eigenvalues, and there's an analytical formula that has been written down. And it has been computed from first principles, right? I mean, it's not that one starts with some prejudice. One says, oh, well, I would rather like the eigenvalues to have these properties, and therefore I write them down. No. There's an operator. There's a Hilbert space. You solve the eigenvalue problem and see what the eigenvalues are. Just interesting tidbits again. I mean, selected at random. There's an area gap. The lowest eigenvalue is, of course, 0. Then there's a first non-trivial eigenvalue, because it's discrete. There's a first non-trivial one. And there's a pretty result, which says that this area gap knows about the topology of the surface. For example, if the surface is open, right, I mean, open surface like that, then the smallest area, non-zero area it can have, turns out to be root 3 upon 4 times Planck length squared. I mean, most of you can immediately recognize that this comes from square root of j into j plus 1, where j happens to be 1/2 kind of thing. On the other hand, if the surface is closed, for example, it's a two-sphere in R3, right? Then the area gap is bigger. It's not the same. It's bigger. It is 2 times square root of 2 upon 4 times Planck length squared. I just wrote it in this form to make it clear that this is bigger than this. There's another thing which is much more interesting. Well, this is interesting for topological reasons. May have some deep things that we are not that have not been investigated. But this is something that is interesting and is going to be important. Namely, if you look at this level spacing, you can ask, is the level spacing uniform like that of a harmonic oscillator, or does the level spacing go to zero as you go to large areas? Well, we have a closed formula, but I mean you can't just look at it and tell. So you need some little bit of estimates and little work. And for one of the computational physics class, one of the students actually computed the first 99 eigenvalues of the area operator. And what we see is that it really is crowding. So for example, you get 1 Planck length squared. There are 9 eigenvalues which are less than 1 Planck length squared. Whereas by the time you go to 2 Planck length squared, there happen to be 99 eigenvalues. This was done for open surface. Otherwise, you have to redo the calculations using thing. In fact, you can put a real bound on this thing. You can write down both analytically and by numerically. One can just put a estimate here. So what one can do is, one can look at what is delta A, that is to say, the difference in an eigenvalue and its next eigenvalue. This is delta S. This is level spacing versus the eigenvalue itself. And what one finds is that there is this exponential behavior and the thing actually goes to zero. And in fact, you can establish analytically a bound which says that it goes to zero faster than exponential of minus the area in the Planck length units. So this is really very rapid. For example, if I take this piece of paper, for this piece of paper, area upon Planck length squared is about 10 to the 77. So it is exponential of minus square root of 38, then, okay, times Planck length squared itself. So the continuum limit is really approached very, very rapidly. And what we'll see, just in the last part, which I'm about to begin, is that normally one might think that, well, I mean, this is all very detailed and this is all very nice, that mathematically one can work this out, but how can it possibly matter? Supposing the spectrum of the area was really uniform, since the level spacing is going to be of the order of Planck length, which is 10 to the Planck length squared, which is 10 to the minus 66 centimeters squared, you'll get a good classical limit, good semi-classical limit, there should be no problem. And we'll see now that, in fact, this is not quite right. The details do matter. So this is the last part of the talk in which I would like to tell you about some checks, some theoretical consistency and experiments. Okay.
Are there any questions? Is the dimensionality of space-time crucial in this calculation or not?
Yeah. So for area, the dimensionality is crucial. We're assuming that the space is three-dimensional in this calculation.
So of course, we have no idea how you did the calculation, to say the least.
There will be pedagogical talks on this subject.
There's an analog of the Hamiltonian.
There's an analog of Hamiltonian, yes. But, I mean, here we're just looking at the area. So, I mean, you know, to calculate the area of general relativity, you don't need to know the dynamics of general relativity in detail. You need to know differential geometry. So you need to know, you know, the formula which says that you should take the determinant of the metric on the two-dimensional surface, take its square root, and you integrate out. So what one does is, one starts with that classical formula, one writes down the corresponding quantum operator. At first, of course, it doesn't make any sense. So you have to regularize it, take the limit, remove the regulator, and the result that you get happens to be how all the consistency properties, like it is generally covariant, etc., etc. And then you take this operator and you compute the eigenvalues. Any other comments or questions? Yeah.
You have states which have very close eigenvalues. Are those states very similar, or they involve putting the area on different lengths? I mean, can I actually make those transitions?
You can make those transitions, right? So you could, for example, have a state in which you could have polymer geometry, and I can have many, many intersections with the surface, for example, and I got another state in which one of the intersections is missing, then the statement is that that state will have one quantum of area, or whatever quantum of area is associated with that particular line, less
right.
than the first
but
one.
What I'm saying is that one, it seems to me, is naturally the Planck length squared away. The delta A that you experience when you make that transition, when you take one length out, is going to be at least a Planck squared. And to make a transition where you change the area by a very small
right.
amount.
So, what you have to worry about is. Good. So, what you have to do is to. You have given the surface and this polymer geometry, there are three things that can happen. One is, of course, you have got an intersection coming from above. There is an intersection from coming from below, and there can be also tangential intersections. So you have to manipulate between the tangential intersection and this intersection, and then the transverse intersections appropriately to get the next level, so to say. But they are close in the sense that you don't do something dramatic. I mean, you manipulate. Okay. So the last part of the talk, which is about theoretical consistency and experiments. Okay, so again, I want to sort of emphasize again the things that it really is glimpses into quantum gravity. It is not that these are the most interesting results, that's why I'm presenting them. I've chosen some results which might be of use, which might be of interest to black hole kind of things because of the other workshop. And secondly, results which give you, convey an idea of where the field is. I mean, what kind of mathematical sophistication or physical questions we are asking. Okay, so one might ask, for example, can we now look at, for example, black holes in this particular picture? Can we construct a microscopic geometry of a black hole from this particular picture? Again, I think you have heard about various pictures about coming from string theory. I think at least certainly Gary had it in his talk in the black hole symposium. And now here is a different approach to the problem. And the picture that arises is the following. We have a three-dimensional space, and this is sort of the black hole. And you think of this surface of the black hole like a soccer ball, which is divided into some elements of area. And the statement is that the reason why this surface, this large black hole, has this area is because there are these polymers which go and hit and make some intersections and induce at each of these intersections certain area. It's the same picture I just drawn. To sort of give, I don't know, it's the same picture. This is a three-dimensional space. Is in the bulk, you've got this polymer geometry that goes and hits. And basically, we do classical physics outside this. And then consistently, one can actually quantize that particular theory. And some picture like this emerges. And then therefore, the picture is that the horizon is really looks like a pinned balloon. In the sense that what we have these flux lines coming in and intersecting up here. And the degrees of freedom that are allowed, again, for those mathematical physicists, these degrees of freedom have to do with Chern-Simons theory, which lives on the boundary. They very roughly can be thought of as vibrational degrees of freedom, very, very roughly, can be thought of as vibrational degrees of freedom of this balloon, which is pinned at this particular intersection. So that's the general picture of a horizon that black hole space standard.
But the previous transparency up to now, it's just some... you gave some description, of course you don't have time to give details, of some kind of quantum geometry. But at some point, Einstein's action is becoming some kind of physics and dynamics, right? Before you can talk about black holes. So
the dynamics is...
You slip that in somehow.
Yeah, so one starts with the Einstein action, one gets the Hamiltonian formulation. Just one sec. One does the Hamiltonian formulation.
No, but you don't only have this geometry, you don't even have continuum of space. Then how do you
put in the action? No, we start with the classical theory.
Oh,
and then you quantize it in the sense of phase space, and you know, it's like a geometrical quantization or something of that particular system. But, well, in this picture we don't have a picture of in this particular way of doing it, we don't have any information, we don't have any ability to know the inside of the black hole. We really treat it as a boundary which satisfies boundary conditions. Which would make it sort of a family of trapped surfaces, really.
So the question about that then, how do you know this is the boundary of the family of trapped surfaces?
Right. So this has to do with the boundary conditions, which gives you chance. Without those boundary conditions, you could not get Chern-Simons theory. In other words, the theory that lives in the boundary knows about the fact that it came from this. There will be some talks on this thing, detailed talks. So I'm not, you know, don't think that this is the end of the story, please.
It's something like a holographic principle?
I can't see a precise formulation of the holographic principle here. I mean, if you just say the fact that I got this horizon, and I'm looking at the horizon, and what matters at the horizon is just these intersections and some data, some quantum numbers that are induced at the intersection. If that is what one means by holography, then yes. But I think when people technically mean, you know, correctly, semi-technically mean by holography, they mean something deeper than that. Steve?
Are there ideas about how to extend this to describe the observations of an infalling observer?
No. I mean, I think this is a relatively recent work. So, I mean, it's not because of... So now, let me say this, which has very little to really to do with this precise picture that I wrote about. So even if you don't want to believe in that picture, this is a very general argument that was given by Bekenstein. And so let me just give you the general argument. And this general argument just says that you could not have, that if you assume that your level spacing for the areas was uniform in any approach, I mean, it doesn't have to do with any specific approach, then there is a little bit of a problem with the semi-classical prediction of Hawking's. That is a general result. And this is the Bekenstein-McKenna problem. And so the idea is the following. Supposing that the level spacing was uniform, so that the nth area level was n times Planck length squared, and let me just use naturalness now on set all the elementary constants equal to 1. So this is just given by n up here. Okay. Then what we see is the following, that the area of the horizon, however, we know goes as mass squared. Just put these things together and you compute the smallest frequency line that will arise from a transition. So I really should have started here. I started here. So let me go back here and explain what I mean. So the picture that Bekenstein McKenna say take is the following, that we've got this black hole, and the black hole has some quantized area in some sense. And when it evaporates, it makes a quantum jump from one quantum state to the next quantum state. Okay? So these are discrete steps. So it's like an atom, like in atomic physics up here. That is the idea up here. And of course, what you get is spectral lines. But like in atomic physics, like black body, the idea is that the spectral lines are sufficiently dense that you would actually get a nice profile up here. That is the general idea up here.
Yeah. Really,
yeah, that's why it is not just fine. So 1 over m is the Hawking temperature
so
itself.
It's like three lines fill up a whole black body,
If you go along this line. I mean, you are ahead of my argument, but that's right. That's what will happen, right, exactly. So m is, so as Joe just said, as always, the 1 upon m is the temperature of the black hole. Therefore, approximately, the peak is at 1 upon m of the spectrum up here. And now, let's suppose that we actually make this, let's suppose that in fact the spectrum just looks like that. And therefore, the only transitions, they're all going to be, you know, all the spectral lines are going to have frequency omega, 2 omega, 3 omega, etc. That's what the frequencies will be. And so the statement is that you will just get, if this was the case, you just get one spectral line at frequency omega 0, one at twice omega 0, thrice omega 0, etc. I've been rough here, but that's what you will get up here. So therefore, this is going to be, although they've argued that the profile looks like the black body, but you just have this such sort of separated spectral lines, and therefore the picture would look rather different from the semi-classical picture that was given to us by Hawking. And this is true even for large black holes. So now, however, we notice that the actual, in the particular model that we have, in the particular theory, the actual level spacing is not uniform. But in fact, it rapidly goes to zero. In fact, it is level spacing is less than or equal to exponential of the area itself, the square root of the area itself in the natural units. Therefore, the delta m's that you will get up here are not going to be of the order of just omega 0, but they are going to be of the order of omega 0 multiplied by this up here. In other words, what we find is that you can have lines with extremely small frequencies. So first of all, you will get lines to the left of the picture. You will get lines to the left of the picture up here. And furthermore, since the level spacing is so small, you will really get that you can really get a sort of dense filling of this particular profile. And what is interesting about this argument is that sort of you're getting interesting checks. First, you would have thought naively that, well, look, for something like large black holes, how can it matter that something like the level spacing is uniform or it goes to zero? The statement is that it does matter. And this was a surprising observation of Bekenstein and Buchanan. And then, so they stopped here, but then the statement is that somewhat later we computed the exact spectrum. And the only remark is that with the exact spectrum, you don't have this Bekenstein-Buchanan problem. 10 minutes. Okay. So let me just give you another example, which will take about five minutes or so. And again, these are just examples that I'm presenting in order to give you the feel for the subject. So one might ask, are there perhaps large quantum gravity effects? I mean, something crazy, right? I mean, we normally don't expect this to happen. But did we miss them out somehow? And the statement is that, in fact, there are some indications that they may well be. And these effects are likely to have to do with sort of the Coulombic aspect of the gravitational field rather than the radiation aspect, rather than the gravitons, so to say. I mean, in a sense, black hole thermodynamics also has to do with the Coulombic aspects of the gravitational field. So there's a model in three dimensions, 2+1-dimensional space-time, in which there is a surprising failure of the classical theory and semi-classical theory. And any time there is a surprising failure of a classical or semi-classical theory, that's a fertile ground for potential experiments. And so I'm just going to present to you this particular model. The nice thing about the model is that it can be solved exactly. So there are no approximations made. You just solve it, you know, brute force and completely solve. And then at the end, you can try to see what physics you can reap from this solution. So first of all, we're in three space-time dimensions, and what we're doing is we're looking at gravity and electromagnetism together. So the idea is that basically you switch on a laser beam. That's the experiment. That's what you, and we want to describe what happens. You know, that's under various conditions, various assumptions about the laser beam, what happens. So the first of all, in three dimensions, it turns out, just by simple arguments, that there are no gravity waves. And therefore the degrees of freedom lie only in the electromagnetic field. Right? And matter determines the metric of the gravitational field completely. So in that sense, there are no radiative aspects, there are no gravitons, but there is only the Coulombic aspect of the gravitational field. Now, this is the green thing is just in, I did not really need it explicitly, but some of these questions came up in Jenny's talk on Friday, because Jenny had this model in which there actually was a quantum metric. And so I just want to say that in this model, there really is a quantum mechanical metric which operates on an infinite-dimensional Hilbert space, and all these questions about causality, fluctuations of light cone, which were asked, can be, and many of them have been analyzed in detail in this particular model. So what we do is, we look at 3+1-dimensional gravity plus electromagnetism in the axisymmetric case. Then the model is solved exactly, so there is rotational symmetry. So everything just depends on the radial coordinate, rho and time. And there is an explicit formula for the metric operator, and there is only one, so to say, operator coefficient. This is a C number, and this operator coefficient is just the following: it's just exponential of the three-dimensional Newton's constant times the energy operator. This is the operator which measures the energy of the electromagnetic field in a box of radius rho at time t. So what you do is you have this electromagnetic field. By suitable gauge choices, you can just quantize it in the standard textbook fashion for quantization, and then this is the operator that you have to put in up here. That requires regularization, but I won't go into that. Okay. Now the experiment is this very, very simple experiment, right? It is that we shine a circular beam, because we're axisymmetric, of laser light in 2+1 dimensions. So this is space, this is time, we shine a beam, and that beam goes out like that. That's the experiment up here. And now we want to describe outcome. And here is the schizophrenia that I told you about in the very first transparency. What is the description of quantum field theory? Well, quantum field theory says we've got three-dimensional Minkowski space, like flat space all around us, and we've got this laser beam. And therefore, the quantum state of the photons is the usual coherent state, and that we know that the classical limit or classical theory, classical Maxwell theory, is good if you have a large number of photons. If you just have h bar not equal to 0, but g equal to 0, I put speed of light equal to 1 everywhere, then there is no natural length or there is no natural frequency scale. So this description holds whether you have small frequency or large frequency, because we don't know what small or large means. On the other hand, you can have a general relativity description. It's very different, right? In general relativity description, we've got a classical electromagnetic field, E and Maxwell field up here. And then what happens is that because of this Maxwell field, because of this light that is coming up here, there's curvature. But the interesting thing is that there's curvature not just in the region, I mean space curls up, so to say, not just in the region where there's light, but you can see the effect of the presence of this light even out at infinity, because the two-dimensional space actually curls up, looks more like a cone, and then there is a deficit angle. So you can be very far away from the beam, and I can go and measure the geometry very far away from the beam, and I can actually find that there is actually a deficit angle up here.
Now, do you need a pulse, not a beam, so it's localized at any given time?
Sorry?
Do you need a pulse or a beam? You need a pulse, don't you? So it's localized at any given time?
It's localized, so I should say pulse. Okay, thank you. Right. No, it's localized at any given time. That's right. But of course, it can disperse. But, right. But there is a deficit angle at infinity. And again, there is no natural frequency scale. So the description is the same, whether you are low frequency, high frequency, blah, blah. All that happens is the space curls up, and this propagates by Maxwell's equation. But now let us come to the case where G is not equal to 0 and H bar is not equal to 0. So full quantum gravity. Well, for luckily, we have a solution in this case. We have a complete solution. We know everything that, in principle, we can answer all the questions. So now, the electromagnetic field and the metric are both operators. And there are quantum fluctuations, both in electromagnetic field and also in the metric field. But the fluctuations in the electromagnetic field are small, as usual, if there are large number of photons. But there is a surprise for the metric. And that occurs, in part, because now there is a natural frequency scale. There is now natural frequency omega Planck. Therefore, physics below Planck frequency would be different from physics above Planck frequency. But the nice thing is that there is going to be a surprise even in physics below Planck frequency. Okay, so what happens? So the idea is that what we can do is, here is a laser beam, as Joe said. It is localized, and I stay away from the laser beam, and I do my physics away from the laser beam. Then I can calculate everything exactly, and then I can just take the leading terms in order to see what is going on. So that's what is done. Everything has been calculated exactly, and then we look at leading terms. So suppose I got this profile of the laser, you know, some peak at some frequency omega 0 up here, and this is the intensity or the amplitude. So if the frequency of the laser is much less than the Planck frequency, as you might imagine, the expectation value of the metric is a classical, is the one that you will get in the classical theory. In other words, you can solve this problem both classically and quantum mechanically, and you can compare the answers. So you get the same as. However, if the frequency is bigger than the Planck length, then the expectation value of the quantum metric is completely different from the expectation value of the classical metric. The expectation value of the quantum metric looks like exponential of the number operator times exponential of omega 0 upon omega Planck, whereas the classical looks like exponential of the number operator times omega 0 upon omega Planck. So there's an additional exponential here. There's a huge difference that occurs up here. Well, what about fluctuations? Well, not surprisingly, if you have a frequency which is much bigger than the Planck frequency, the fluctuations here are large. But again, I want to emphasize, these fluctuations are not in the region where the beam is, but they are in the region outside the beam. Okay, this is... Joe is shaking his head.
This is very special.
Absolutely. I'll just talk about... Exactly. So I'll just mention about the four-dimensional thing in a second. That's absolutely right, yeah. However, if you look at fluctuations now, then even for low energy up here, low frequency up here, something surprising happens. Namely, the fluctuations in the metric are small only, you can compute what it is, and they're small only if the number of photons multiplied by this omega 0 upon omega t whole squared is much less than 1. But for the fluctuation in the Maxwell field to be small, we want n to be very large, but we want the frequency to be so small that n times this thing is much smaller than 1. So that's what we get. Okay. So what is the mechanism? Why does this happen? Well, what happens is basically that small quantum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field are magnified by non-linearities of Einstein equations, and only the Coulombic gravitational field is involved here. So that is just a magnification effect. but it's a huge magnification effect. This is an essentially non-perturbativity effect, in the sense that, for example, if I linearize a theory, I don't see this at all, it just disappears. Similarly, you might say, well, can you do an analogous calculation for Maxwell theory? In other words, you can consider Maxwell-Klein-Gordon system instead of Einstein-Maxwell system, say spherical system, which only has Coulombic degrees of freedom. Can you do that? Well, you can do the calculations, but there is no this magnification effect, because it really has to do with the non-linearities which are there in the gravity theory. Finally, if you can look at the semi-classical gravity as an approximate description, we often do that, not as a fundamental theory, but as an approximate description. So the basic fundamental equation that we have is this, where this should have been expectation value of the stress energy tensor. And in this particular case, the semi-classical gravity actually admits an infinite number of solutions, exact solutions. That means I got a classical metric, Maxwell field propagating on the classical background, and a state of the system such that this equation holds. But these semi-classical states, these semi-classical solutions, are completely inadequate to capture what is going on in the full theory unless this condition holds. And this condition, without knowing the full theory, so to say, it would have been very somewhat difficult to really get this condition, because it looks like in relatively tame situations, you know, you have got a macroscopic field with large number of photons, nice field, and relatively low frequency, but this condition is violated, then there is a problem. So now the key question is, do such effects exist in four dimensions? As David already pointed out, there's a difference between four and three dimensions because of this long-range effect. Namely, outside sources, the metric is the same in three dimensions, whereas in four dimensions, there's a tail effect which goes as 1 upon r. But if you do a similar kind of calculation, actually it has to do with the spherical symmetric Klein-Gordon field that Matt Chopkick talked about, to do anything exact does not seem to be possible. Approximation methods are complicated. But if you just look at the pattern of the terms, it looks like the pattern of the term is very similar to what happens in three dimension, except that there is a 1 upon r Coulombic drop-off of all these effects. So in other words, the statement is that if you are very, very far, they will die. But I think it's very interesting to calculate if there is an intermediate regime in which these effects might be significant. So this is a second example. And the last example is just in one line. I really don't know too much about it, and I'm starting with this last example because I hope this will start a dialogue between the two programs in some detail. It's a very nice problem that all of us have in a sense. And it is that, can we experimentally check these large, possible quantum gravity effects? So idea is that almost all theories of quantum gravity, string theory, quantum geometry, whatever it is, say that the smooth continuum geometry isn't there, there's going to be some quantum fluctuations of the geometry at some level. And the idea is, can we test, can we get an experimental hold on that? And the idea has been proposed that perhaps we could do the following. You see, look at what happened in high energy theory. There, one wanted to do experiments on proton decay. Now the particles which mediate proton decay have tended to this 16 GeV, and one doesn't want to produce this particle copiously in an accelerator and see if the proton decays or something. So what one did was, instead, one can consider a very large number of protons, right? And there, even though these particles are very rare, nonetheless the question is, does the proton decay? Are there any decays among very, very large number of protons? And these experiments are successful in the sense that they actually put bounds and they actually eliminated some of the proposed scenarios. And so now the question is, can something like this happen? And the idea is that perhaps if you look at these gamma ray flares, then these gamma rays are traveling on cosmological distances. Because of the quantum fluctuations, right, it is as though there is a really medium. So there is a small dispersion effect. And the question is, by the time you come, in any small region, that dispersion effect is completely negligible. However, it could perhaps accumulate as you come from a very, very large distances, cosmological distances. So this large distance is the analog of large number of protons. And now the question is, does it happen indeed that dispersion and some other effects which have been proposed are caused by the quantum nature of geometry on propagation of electromagnetic waves. Although these effects are very small, they could accumulate, and there could be perhaps effects on cosmological distances.
Exactly what effects are you talking about?
It basically has to do with dispersion. So the statement is that it's like a medium in some sense. So the statement is that you don't have, this is a proposal that people have made, that you won't have the speed of light, the dispersion relation won't be just a straight line, but it will be frequency dependence. And perhaps we can look at the time of arrival of this gamma ray flares and the frequency, and from there one can actually put some bounds. And there is actually a paper from, you know, as you probably know, an observational paper which actually tries to put bounds on this, and looking at the gamma ray bursts which came from the flare, 1996 flare. No, I don't have it here. From a gamma ray flare which came in 1996, and puts limits that in fact up to 10 to the minus 16 G, up to 10 to the 16 GeV, that energy scale. In fact, the continuum picture is perfectly fine. One doesn't see any contributions to quantum gravity to this dispersion.
That made a very specific assumption about the form of the dispersion. Right?
Absolutely.
Which is not necessarily natural.
Absolutely. So, exactly. Right. So the downside of this is exactly what Amanda was just saying, namely that. But I think it's up to us. Now, these guys are actually doing this experiment, right? So it's up to us to come out and say with some level of confidence, right? Look, this is realistic. This is not realistic. And I sort of feel that we owe it to them, and so we should do it. And that is my point of view. Not because we'll succeed, but at least just okay. That's it. Thank you very much.
About the large fluctuations in the metric. The metric you wrote down had in it the operator, which you said represented the energy of the field in a cylinder of a fixed, a definite radius. Now, quantum field theory, that kind of an operator will have large fluctuations just because you're specifying very sharply the region that you're summing up the energy in. Is that the origin of the fluctuations?
No. So, first of all, the fluctuation I talked about really had to do with, therefore, one of the reasons I stayed outside the light beam. Then I'm really talking about the total energy. For a given coherent state, I'm really talking about the total energy, and it really is like the total Hamiltonian and so on, so there is no problem. But coming back to the other question you asked, we had tried to regularize this operator. And a rigorous, I mean, in other words, it was not mathematically, communications of mathematical physics rigor, but a rigorous proof of regularization of this local operator was recently obtained by Madhavan, and I think there's a paper on the thing. So I think one can now take that operator and really see what is going on in the interior.
So if you have quantization and fluctuations in geometry, what about topology? Is that always going to be fixed?
I think it is completely, one is doing topology by topology here, so it's not fixed in that sense of the word. There are vague ideas about how one might... There is an interplay between knot theory and all this way of doing quantum gravity. And there is an interplay between classification of knots and classification of manifolds. Building these ideas, bridging these ideas together, there is a general direction of thought as to how one might want to incorporate topologies. But this is not something that has been done in any detail at all.
One reason I ask is because you were talking about the spectrum on a closed surface versus an open one, and if you have sort of fluctuating topology, you're not even sure what you mean by that.
I agree with you. So the statement is that one would just say that, it depends on what the final theory is going to be, right? I mean, so maybe, are there super-selected sectors? In other words, are the states corresponding to one topology orthogonal to another, in which case one can talk about this. If they're not orthogonal to another, whether one cannot talk about this. So I do not know which one. And in other words, one is not talking about the realistic thing.
You have eigenspace.
Sorry?
You have eigenspace. Your Hilbert space depends on the choice of the boundary.
Our Hilbert space? It is, the numerical factors may, but not the construction, in the sense that
you... And you can answer the question. You said you had eigenspace. It follows then by topology.
Right, but I think he's talking about topology change of the three manifold completely. I was talking about topology.
There are two different topological issues, and I think that one and another is actual topology change of, say, the universe.
Right, I thought that was what he was talking about.
Well,
so,
you first asked whether the
I was talking
you
about.
Can answer that.
Right, we can answer. So the statement that is they are talking about, construction, and it's not very deep.
Do Is this dispersion effect a generic property of quantum gravity, or it depends on the theory of the model? Would you expect it in every quantum gravity?
At some level, I would expect it in every theory. But I mean, as Amanda was saying, the question is, what level does it occur? Is it an effect at the leading order, as is assumed in the papers that actually were published, or is it really coming to the next order? If it comes to the next order, it's going to be so small that we won't really see it at all.
It is a necessary property.
I have a couple questions about the super fundamental example.
Okay.
First, there is a maximum amount of mass you can have in the super fundamental universe. So are you, just to make sure I got it right, are you working with something with less than that upper bound and then boosting it to get a high frequency?
No, I think the frequency, good. No. The, it's a very interesting model. So the statement is that, yeah, I think I was not being... I'm not being as clear and sharp as I could have been. Namely, when I'm talking about frequency and such things, I'm really referring to an asymptotic rest frame. In other words, you compute the ADM momentum, and I'm talking about that asymptotic rest frame, basically. Now, what is interesting about this whole thing is that you could have arbitrarily high energies, arbitrarily high frequencies, but the energy is still bounded for the following reason. That the total Hamiltonian, this is a completely non-perturbativity effect in 2 plus 1 dimensions with matter, that the total Hamiltonian is given by 1 upon, I think, I may not get the factor right, 4g, 1 minus e to the minus, in the picture that we talked about here, this is the sort of the flat space Hamiltonian of the Maxwell field. I think there's g here. So the thing is that as you increase the frequency, this can increase unboundedly. This is just the, this is a mathematical quantity. This is the quantity that you write down, integral of energy up here. So this can increase as you increase the frequency, but the total Hamiltonian still remains bounded. As you take the frequency to infinity, this will be just minus infinity, and then the maximum bound is actually achieved up here.
Can you, okay, so the second question is, can you do a similar thing for two photons?
Yeah, yeah, you could do so, absolutely. And the whole thing was done more generally.
And the maximum 104g is when the fuzzy, that's Daniel's 2 pi.
Yeah, the day this cycle is too high. That's exactly.
I think any dispersion of light in string theory is going to be utterly negligible. For example, the index of refraction of the 3 degree background produces a much larger effect than anything string theory will ever produce, and that's something you're never going to see.
But these people are very careful. I mean, this is my first question. Right? I mean, that's not. I'll tell you the names of these people, and we will write down the. This is GRQC. I mean, I better not tell you the name because the name is huge. There's about 4 lines of names. Yeah. Right. So their point is that somehow they understand. I mean, this is what I would like to really get from the gamma ray, you know, conference that we're going to have, and maybe some informal discussion sessions. But just talking to people just after the talk or after a conference or something, the feeling, the claim, as I understand it, maybe I'm misunderstanding it, is that they know those effects, so they can account for them. And then they'll tell you, is there anything left over or is there not left over? That is the answer that I get. Now, I don't know if this is I misunderstood it or what they're saying. Anyway, this paper, if anybody's interested, this is GRQC. This is an observational paper.
The basic position I'm making on it is that whatever string theory does to geometry, it preserves the Lorentz invariance. And so if there's dispersion, the dispersion is due to some violation of the Lorentz invariance. And if you have one part of the Lorentz invariance in our universe, the fact that you're moving through a background that has a rest frame.
Okay, so you're saying that there's not even a matter of at what level it would happen, it just cannot happen, is that what you're saying?
No, there are effects. But they have to break the Lorentz invariance.
Right, but I thought last comment that. I agree, they have to break out.
The RSS, you're putting numbers, the break is incredibly small. Smaller than the universe is large,
by
quite a lot.
Okay.
These guys actually refer to a paper by
including
one of the
authors. I think it's probably Savas. Nanopoulos.
And they claimed that there were some string theory models that they could write down in which they could get this linear dispersion correction. And I don't think there's many string theorists here who would agree with
that. I agree with you. I there are many, many doubts there. But my point of view is really the modest one, namely saying, well, look, these guys are actually putting some bounds there. I mean, either we have to come out and say that, well, no, I mean, this is, as everybody's saying.
I think we can say they'll have a long future of putting bounds.
The other was, is it still a hard question to recover Newtonian nearly flat plate physics from the, your framework, or is that now a solved question?
Newtonian physics,
sir. Yes.
Lorentzian scattering, yeah. I think one can just make a...
Is it a hard question?
It depends on what we mean by first principles, right? That's the point. I mean, if I just say that, well, I got a background, which I just choose, which is a background weave, which I just choose once and for all, and that is supposed to correspond to Minkowski space, then you can do perturbation theory. But this is only the first order correct term that we are obtaining.
You have a Hamiltonian, you can write down a state which is flat space plus two gravitons and
there's ambiguity in writing the what is flat space, but we could write down a state which should be approximately flat space, and then one could actually there is a description of linear what we normally call linear as Guyton in terms of these perturbations around these weave states.
So
that has been that's right.
You've linearized gravity, but you haven't scattered two gravitons yet, right?
So the statement is about it's not to any. You are right. I think absolutely right. Gary is absolutely right. So the statement is that this is linear as gravity, but one should actually take these things and actually scan. Sorry, I think Peter is...
I was wondering, there's been this preprint on the calculation of an effect like these in loop gravity of Poulin and Gambinian. So there apparently one would be able to measure the dispersion of gamma rays if one...
If the state has a particular form.
Right.
I mean, the quantum state required in the universe has a particular property.
So the idea that has been pursued is that, well, you make a table, right? If the state of we don't have enough control on what the precise state is. But if the state is this, then there will be this dispersion. If the state is that, then there will be no dispersion. So it's not sort of a hard prediction in the sense that, somebody can go and look for it. But on the other hand, if you found that effect, then there will be a... I mean, you can go back and say, that's telling us something about the state, and there is a consistency argument.
Right, and I suppose the statement was that Ferrazzi needed to make measurements at GeV energies or less than millisecond times.
Right.
Yeah.
I think a lot of these topics are going to be discussed in the pedagogical lectures and the program. So let's think how they get it.
Thank you, David. Thank you.